You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite the fact that guns are among the most contentious issues in the American culture, especially in the wake of mass shootings in places like Columbine, Virginia Tech, Tucson, and Aurora, our national conversation about them is either non-existent or frozen in what seems like perpetual gridlock. In his latest book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment, former New York Times assistant managing editor Craig R. Whitney examines our complicated relationship with firearms and proposes a few areas of common ground for both sides. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Whitney to our program today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
You describe this book as an attempt to diffuse the hysteria around the Second Amendment. What do you think both sides of this debate get wrong about guns?
Well, I think the side that supports gun rights, the NRA in particular, exaggerates beyond any resemblance to the truth the possibility that liberals who think that strict gun control is the way to control gun violence really want to take their guns away, everybody's guns away. And liberals don't counter that impression strongly enough or often enough. I think if they did, then they'd take away one of the NRA's main points.
Well, what do you think that Obama's going to take our guns away idea comes from? He said, and this is a direct quote, "I will not take your shotgun away. I won't take your handgun away." And yet, no matter how many ways he says that, there seems to be a sense among many gun owners that the president has a plan to do precisely that.
Because the NRA keeps telling him he does. All during the last year of the election campaign, the NRA was telling its members and asking them, me and the other members of the NRA, to contribute to ensure the defeat of President Obama, who was not only going to take away our guns, but all our freedoms if he was reelected.
Now, he's done a pretty good job so far, hasn't he?
As you pointed out, he had never done anything, really, in his first term that resembled gun control. In fact, he signed two measures into law. One allows you to take a gun onto an Amtrak train if it's in a container, and another one allows you to take a loaded gun into a national forest. Well, how is that taking your guns away?
If anything, it just angered many liberals.
Yes, indeed.
But didn't gun sales soar after he was elected in 2008?
Oh, yeah. They've kept soaring because the NRA keeps saying, you know, don't believe him when he says he doesn't want to take your guns away. He does. Better get them while you still can, because when he gets a chance, he'll appoint Supreme Court justices who will take our gun rights away.
Now, better get them while you still can. It seems rather ironic when you look at the Small Arms Survey estimate that in 2007 in the United States there were 88 guns for every 100 Americans. I imagine that's gone up. And that means we have the highest gun ownership rate of any place in the world. The country that comes in second, a rather dangerous place, is Yemen. It has 55 guns per 100 people.
I would have thought Afghanistan, but anyway.
Well, I'm sure that there are hidden guns in a lot of places, but there are hidden guns in this country too. We
Indeed.
Really have no idea.
Indeed.
With 88 guns per 100 Americans, that means that there are some people out there, because I don't have any, who have a lot of guns.
Well, there are a lot of people with multiple guns, but they don't forget that a lot of these guns are rifles and guns used for hunting, not pistols, which are more commonly used for self-defense. But I'd say there are more rifles out there than pistols. But the problem that causes gun violence is the availability of illegal guns and the many criminals who use guns illegally or have them illegally. That's the problem here in New York.
But the attempts to make certain kinds of gun ownership illegal have all been beaten back. As I understand it, you could be somebody who is on the terrorist list but still buy a gun.
Well, don't forget there are a lot of people whose names appeared on the terrorist list who really shouldn't have been there and had terrible trouble getting off. But the problem isn't, and I keep telling my liberal friends this, that the problem isn't that too many people like us have guns. It's how do you keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, who everybody agrees shouldn't have them? That's what we need to try to do.
But let's take a case like Aurora, where a number of gun supporters said, well, if somebody had had a gun in that theater, they could have stopped that whole thing. They could have shot James Holmes, and that would have been the end of it. But what I imagined was a bunch of people shooting at where they saw gunshots coming from and killing each other, and a lot more people might have died as a result.
I think so, too. And that's what the police always say in answer to that argument. And, you know, if you're a cop who's called to the scene of a disaster like that, the last thing you want to find is a room full of people with guns shooting them at potentially you.
That was the Batman massacre in Colorado, and James Holmes had several weapons, including an assault rifle. He had purchased thousands of rounds of ammunition. He was wearing body armor. You would have thought that some people would have said, we can't allow that sort of thing.
Well, I think the main failure there was that given his mental state, which was not unknown to the university where he had been studying,
he talked about killing with his psychiatrist.
Right. What can we do to make it more efficient to get the names of people like that who are mentally unstable or are have been recommended to a mental treatment of some kind onto the National Instant Check System database in Washington or that the FBI runs? He couldn't have bought his guns if his name had been on that list. Now, maybe the discovery of his mental illness and his gun purchases were too close together, but tightening up that system, I think, would go a long way towards making this sort of thing at least less likely to happen.
Well, we also have privacy laws which protect people against that kind of information being revealed.
Right, and we ought to think twice about things like that. Almost all of these gun massacres that we've seen have been perpetrated by people who are clearly mentally ill.
Although the shooting occurred in the middle of a presidential campaign, neither side even brought up the issue of gun control.
No, because the Democrats are terrified of it, and the NRA has everybody else over barrel on it. So,
and as I understand it, after a mass shooting and the news stories about it, the sales of particular types of guns actually spike.
Well, because Obama mentioned in the last of the three presidential debates that he might be amenable to trying to reinstate the ban on assault weapons. By the way, they're misnomer. Assault weapons are fully automatic rifles used in the military, whereas these are guns like assault weapons that look like military weapons. They're only semi-automatic. You have to squeeze the trigger each time to get a round off. You can squeeze off an awful lot of rounds, as this guy did in Aurora. But because Obama says things like that, naturally all the people who really are dead set on getting themselves an assault rifle
for what reason?
Well, for sport, among other things.
Well, you mean you can shoot how many deer in a row? I mean, if you just pulling the trigger again and again and again,
you wouldn't shoot with deer with a rifle like that.
Yeah, well, who would you shoot? Well, what would you shoot with it?
You could shoot
a lot of bottles and cans.
Target practice. Oh, okay. I've done it myself
assault rifle
with an AK-47. Yeah, it's. You know,
it sounds like a lot of fun.
It can be fun, but a lot of people buy these because they want to use them for self-defense. I don't see it because, you know, where are you going to keep a weapon like that in your home, and how easy is it going to be to get to it if somebody comes in intent on robbing you?
And if somebody breaks through my door, do I really need a gun that can shoot off 100 rounds?
No, you don't. And you don't need a round one. You shouldn't have a 100-round weapon like that anyway. I mean, a magazine like that anyway, unless you're going to use it at a shooting range.
Well, these actions always seem to get a reaction. We wound up with a state actually naming its own state gun as a result of, in the aftermath of Aurora, you would have thought it would have gone the other direction. Is this just because it's accepted as part of the American culture? Are there so many guns in America simply because of the Second Amendment, or because other countries don't have this kind of relationship?
Well, the Second Amendment didn't create the right to have guns. The Second Amendment simply recognized a right that colonists had in America right since Jamestown and even the Massachusetts colony. You needed to have a gun back in the colonial days to hunt, to get food, and you also needed it against the possibility of attack by Native Americans, who soon came to see that these settlers weren't there just to make friends with them and teach them the ways of the white man in Europe, but to squat on their lands and seize them.
So, but we didn't give them the right to own firearm.
No, we tried to prevent it, but unsuccessfully. The Indians wanted guns just as much as the colonists did.
So you say that the reason that we had the Second Amendment was the reason the other amendments were in the Bill of Rights, to protect Americans from tyranny that could be imposed by a strong federal government. I thought it was about to prevent us from to protect us during an invasion. Did the Second Amendment apply during the War of 1812 when we were invaded by the British?
It certainly was in force.
Were militias out there suddenly formed by people who had these guns?
In a lot of states, the militias refused to serve. The War of 1812 was kind of a disaster as far as the militia system went. There wasn't great enthusiasm for it in some states, like Massachusetts, for instance. But yes, it was enforced. But there was an act, the 1792 Militia Act, which required all adult white males, anyway, to equip themselves with guns and to have them ready to be called up when they were called up to serve.
And it was white males because of slavery and because there was also this continuing war against Native Americans.
Right.
That's the way things were for a long time. And we really didn't see the Supreme Court get into the act until fairly late in the game. What brought the courts into it?
Exactly. The history of the Supreme Court and gun rights is pretty blank through most of the 19th century. The first time the Supreme Court ruled on or even mentioned the Second Amendment in a ruling importantly was in 1876. And
talking about a whole century, practically.
After the passage of the amendment, almost. What they said in 1876 was that the right to keep and bear arms was not a right granted by the Constitution. So it was a pre-existing right. That's all they said. The case involved a massacre of blacks in Colfax, Louisiana, who their defense claimed that the people who shot them deprived them of their rights, including the right to keep and bear arms. Well, the Supreme Court said that's not a right granted by the Constitution. And 10 years after that, the Supreme Court said the Second Amendment applied only to the federal level, to Congress and the executive. They couldn't pass laws that would infringe on gun rights.
So why have things turned around, starting largely in 2008 when the Supreme Court started expanding gun rights? Didn't they have this precedent? Aren't many of the conservatives on the court people who strongly believe that the decisions of earlier courts should be respected?
Yes, and they cited them, but I think they twisted them to come to the conclusion they wanted to. Scalia did in his majority opinion.
He twists the law, Scalia?
He certainly got interpreted the historical record of the passage of the Second Amendment in ways that surprised me. They were not talking about self-defense when they were arguing about the Second Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights. They were talking about a political move they needed to make to get enough states to ratify the Constitution. So these were additional controls on the power of the federal government. Politics is what it was about, not about self-defense. But in the 2008 ruling, they struck down a District of Columbia ban, essentially, on handguns and said handguns were the most commonly used weapon for self-defense, and that was the primary purpose of the Second Amendment.
But since the Second Amendment was only supposed to apply to individual states and not apply a federal approach, the court was saying just the opposite, wasn't it?
Well, no, it was.
If Washington, D.C. can't come up with its own law, or New York or other states.
It was ruling on the District of Columbia only. That's a federal jurisdiction. But 2 years after that, in 2010, they ruled in a case involving Chicago, McDonald versus Chicago, that this ruling of that gun rights were individual rights and always had been applied to the states as well.
My guest is Craig R. Whitney, who spent his entire professional career as a reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor at the New York Times, where he was assistant managing editor in charge of standards and ethics when he retired in 2009. His most recent book is called Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. It is published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Craig R. Whitney. His latest book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment, is published by Public Affairs. How did the National Rifle Association go from being a sportsman's organization to one of the most powerful and feared lobbying groups in Washington?
Well, I think it was largely a backlash that did it, because they were the leadership of the NRA supported some aspects of the 1968 Gun Control Act, which was passed after all those terrible assassinations, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, President Kennedy in the 60s. That leadership was overthrown in the late 60s or 70s, early 70s, when people began to realize that the Gun Control Act applied to everybody, not just, you know, potential assassins. And the backlash from that, I think, enabled the new leaders of the NRA to strike a quite different note, which they've been doing ever since. Charlton Heston's, you know, From My Cold Dead Hands and all that. He had actually signed on to a statement that was read on a TV show calling for the gun controls in 1968. Well, you know, he wasn't doing that in the 80s and 90s.
Well, it's my sense that it's Wayne LaPierre who really has been the guiding force.
The executive vice president, yeah, of the NRA. And they resist violently all kinds of gun control. I agree with the NRA on one thing, which is that gun controls alone are never going to solve our gun violence problem. But there are some kinds of gun control that are perfectly reasonable that that everybody accepts today. Like, you can't just go out and buy a Tommy gun. Most people can't anyway, because they haven't been able to do that since the 1934 Firearms Act, which the Supreme Court upheld.
In a column for the New York Times last July, you wrote, "Liberals should accept that the only realistic way to control gun violence is not by keeping guns out of the hands of as many Americans as possible, but by keeping guns out of the hands of people we all agree should not have them." Now, that's what gun control advocates have been saying for years. Even the Brady campaign says clearly on its website, "Brady believes that a safer America can be achieved without banning guns. We believe that law-abiding citizens should be able to buy and keep firearms." So what's the problem here?
You can't do that in New York City. If I wanted to
get a license and I could
Well, you can't get one. You will not be able to get one. The police decide whether you need a gun. Now, you know, when you go get a driver's license, they don't decide whether you need a car. They give you the driver's license. You can go get a car. You cannot do that with a gun here in New York City.
Yeah, but a driver's license, you have to be able to take a test to drive the car. And we don't have anything like that here. In some countries like England, you can own a rifle, but it's kept under lock and key. And then when you want to go and target shoot or you want to go hunting, you take it out of that locked space. You bring it back and lock it up again. Couldn't we do something like that?
Yeah, that's possible. and there are states with regulations that do require you to take a course and demonstrate that you know how to use a gun safely and store it safely and all that. You can, but in New York City, the prevailing philosophy, certainly expressed by Mayor Bloomberg, is the fewer guns we have, the better, period. So it's better for you and me not to have guns. How does that, though, control gun violence?
Well, it's not just gun violence. There are many people who die from gun accidents, kids who find guns, their parents' guns, or people who are cleaning guns and they go off. And I think there's a very high number.
Well, the total number of deaths from guns has ranged in recent years around 30,000, of which half are suicides. Half. There are far fewer deaths from accidents but a lot of injuries. That's certainly true.
And I suspect that if people didn't have guns, there would be fewer suicides, because it's harder to do some of the other things that you would have to do. You actually have to get a prescription to get the pills that will kill you. Jumping off of a bridge is out of buildings reserved for very few people.
And it's not.
And
safe.
Holding your breath doesn't
for
work.
Other people.
A listener wonders about the demographics of gun ownership. Who owns the most guns in America, and where do they live?
Well, I think without a doubt, most of the gun owners in America are in rural areas of the United States, not in cities. And as I said, most of the weapons are hunting rifles, not pistols.
So why has this become – because we're talking about the same people who live in red state areas. Mm-hmm. Why has it become so political?
Well, because –
if the Democrats – many Democrats are not really promoting gun control. And as far as I have heard, Mayor Bloomberg is not a Democrat.
No, but he supported President Obama, and I'm
this
sure
time.
this time, and I'm sure he the conflict between urban and rural America is not just about guns or gun rights. It's about a lot of things. We've seen this in the last election. We don't agree on a lot of things, and laws shouldn't be the same, I don't think, about guns. In Wyoming, Texas, and Montana as they are in New York City or Chicago. And I don't think the people in Montana should have the right to overturn New York City's gun laws. If we want to do that, we should do it ourselves. We know best what works and what doesn't work.
And we're not out there hunting for deer in the streets of New York City, are we?
Not, and sir, you wouldn't find any in the streets of Manhattan. But there are hunters. I know a friend of mine who lives in my building in Brooklyn has hunting rifles, which he's able to keep in his at home. But he has a license that requires him to keep them locked when he transports them to out of state or upstate to go hunting. People can do that, but it's very limited.
My guest is Craig R. Whitney. His latest book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another listener points out that despite the fact that there are many guns in America, hasn't the actual number of gun owners gone down?
Yes. I don't have the exact figures on it, but there are fewer people owning guns, but they own more guns than they used to, is what it comes down to.
Mm. And what's the justification of owning all of these guns? I can understand owning a firearm from the Civil War because it's historic. It's like owning armor or a sword from the Middle Ages. But how many assault rifles does one person need?
I would say none if you live in a city. But there are people who enjoy shooting at ranges and people who hunt. Maybe their kids as they grow up hunt and you want to have a gun for them and teach them how to use a gun safely. So, you know, there are good reasons to have more than one gun if you live in certain parts of the country, certainly.
Could gun control advocates learn something from the absolutism of the NRA by refusing to compromise about gun rights and standing firm? Because that's what the NRA does, and they seem to get whatever they want. If there were a lobby that actually said we can get a lot of voters to vote against certain politicians, we saw that in other areas like women's reproductive rights during this last election.
Well, the Brady group has been trying to do that, but with a lot less success, and they can't raise money.
And what do you think that
is? Well, I think that the NRA has been going so long with this message that we're all out to take their guns away that it scares people. And I think the most effective way to fight them would be to concede and make clear that you've conceded, that it is, as the Supreme Court has said it is, an individual right that belongs to all Americans. So you take that off the table. We're not going to deprive you of your gun rights. What we're going to try to do is make it safer for you who own guns and want to use them, and for the people who are around you. That should be the object of gun control.
Well, you mentioned earlier that there was the Gun Control Act of 1968, which I think probably had as much ado with the feeling around the country that the country was going to hell in a handbasket, along with concern about the assassinations. This was also a time of demographic changes, the 60s culture coming in and people being a little afraid.
Right.
So what happened? The same people who would have been afraid of these gun-bearing hippies like Charles Manson, they're now the ones who are saying we should let Charles Manson's people have guns.
It's backlash again. In 1969, there was a commission headed by Dwight Eisenhower's brother, Milton Eisenhower, that had been appointed by President Johnson to study how to control gun violence around the country. It recommended seizing all 28 million, I think it was, handguns they counted in the United States at the time, outlawing them. Well, you know, gun owners see something like that and they think, oh, my God, you know, this Gun Control Act isn't just aimed against the Black Panthers who fought for the right to have guns in California. It's going to affect me. We don't want that. And the backlash is what caused the overturning of the leadership of the NRA and led to so much resistance to the idea of gun control in the 70s and 80s.
Well, now we come to the Trayvon Martin case. And in recent years, a number of states have passed so-called Stand Your Ground and Castle Doctrine laws, which make it legal to shoot in self-defense, even if you're outside your home and even if you haven't done your best to thwart an attacker by other means, like trying to run away. This is a new thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's appalling. I mean, if I were a legislator, I'd be ashamed of voting for a law that made it easier to kill people, and that's what these do. How often was it that people who were in danger of suffering grievous bodily harm from an attacker been unable to respond if they had a gun and been prosecuted for it? How often did that happen? Was this law really necessary? I think the Florida law also had a dangerous invitation to vigilantism in it.
But it also has a built-in defense of being able to carry a concealed weapon to defend yourself. Now, in an article for The New Yorker about contemporary gun laws, Jill Lepore, I'm sure you didn't agree with her completely on this, wrote, when carrying a concealed weapon for self-defense is understood not as a failure of civil society to be mourned, but as an act of citizenship to be vaunted, there's little civilian life left.
Well, I don't wholly agree with that, but carrying a gun is one thing. Being encouraged to use it, shoot first, by a Stand Your Ground or Castle Doctrine law is quite another.
Do you think that some of this comes out of the movies?
Well, yes. In fact, actually, the NRA says that sometimes, that the real danger and the real reason why criminals use guns is they see so much shooting and blood on television and in movies. I don't buy that argument, but you do see an awful lot of gun violence in movies these days.
The 1994 federal ban on the possession, transfer, and manufacture of semi-automatic assault weapons was allowed to expire in 2004. Is there any way that that law could be reinstated? And should it be, in your opinion?
Well, in the book, I point out that it was grandfathered when it was in effect from 94 to 04. If you had bought an assault rifle, so-called assault rifle, before then, you could keep it. and unless the only way to get rid of assault rifles is to seize them all, and I just don't see how that's possible. And reinstating the ban wouldn't really be any more effective than the ban was in those 10 years in reducing violence perpetrated by weapons of that sort.
Well, nearly 40% of the guns purchased in the United States are unregulated because they're purchased through gun show loophole. Do you believe it should be closed?
Yes. I think it's more like 40%.
I thought I said 40%.
Did you say 40? Yeah. It's not just at gun shows, though. It's private sales of all kinds, of which the sales at gun shows are probably only a small part of that. Yeah, 40% of our gun sales are completely unregulated. You don't have to go through a buyer doesn't have to be pass the national instant background check that you have to when you buy from a dealer. I think that loophole certainly ought to be closed.
Illegal guns have been among the stated targets of the controversial stop and frisk program here in New York City. The mayor says it's been effective, and we do have a rapid decline in violent crime in this country since the 1990s. Do you think that decline has actually encouraged gun sales or led people to think maybe I don't need to buy a gun?
No, I think the NRA keeps saying, violent crime and the possibility of your being attacked at home is worse than ever. So go get yourself a gun and carry it. You're right you're pointing out that violent crime nationally has declined dramatically over the last 15 years because the crack epidemic waned. That's why. But groups like the NRA refuse to recognize that because if they did, it would hurt themselves in fundraising efforts, I think.
Well, the NRA has also opposed gun registration laws or a safety agency to monitor gun manufacture. Why? It seems to me if you can trace the ownership of a gun that's been used in a crime to somebody, that would be a good idea if the rest of the people who have guns, it wouldn't matter.
And there's nothing in the Second Amendment or in the history of how guns were used in America before the Second Amendment that is that rules out registration, not by the federal government, but by local jurisdictions and states. And yes, we're crazy to deprive ourselves of the tools we need to trace weapons to the criminals who perpetrated the crimes with them.
Many gun control advocates feared that the Heller decision in 2008 would open the floodgates of illegal challenges to other gun laws. Has that happened?
Well, there have been some challenges, but there certainly have not been a raft of laws like the one in the District of Columbia overthrown.
Craig R. Whitney spent his entire professional career in journalism at the New York Times. He was assistant managing editor in charge of standards and ethics when he retired in 2009. He's written a couple of books, the most recent, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. It is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.